I had a place that I went every day for secret prayers. It seemed to me as I prayed that a cloud rested upon my head, and I felt that if the cloud would break, there would be a message for me or some new light. I did not know that it concerned anyone but myself. But then one day, Hannah, one of my husband's sisters, came in and after spending a short time in the house, asked me if I would take a walk with her. She had heard the gospel preached by a Mormon and believed it and had been baptized. She commenced and related the whole of Joseph's vision and what the angel Moroni had said, the mission he had called him to. It came to my mind in a moment that this was the message that was behind the cloud for me, and not for me only, but for the whole world, and I considered it of more importance than anything I had ever heard before. For it brought back the ancient order of things and laid a foundation that could be built upon that was permanent, a foundation made by him that laid the foundation of the earth, even the Almighty God. I read the Book of Mormon, the Doctrine and Covenants, and all the writings I could get from the Latter-day Saints. It was the Book of Doctrine and Covenants that confirmed my faith in the work. I knew that no man, nor set of men, could make such a book or would dare try from any wisdom that man possessed. I knew it was the work of God and a revelation from heaven and received it as such. I sought with my whole heart a knowledge of the truth and obtained a knowledge that never has, nor never will, leave me. Sarah Studevant Levitt.
Hi, this is Lindsay Hanson Park.
And this is Brian Buchanan.
Bringing you the story of Mormonism from the shadow of the everlasting hills, straight out of Zion. This isn't your grandpa's Mormon history.
Well, I have sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I have sinned so gravely, Brother Young.
This is the tale of Mormon saints and sinners, from our roots until present day. Saddle up.
Gird your loins, lock your hearts, and pay your tithing, because we're bringing you the story of Mormonism in all its paradisiacal glory.
It's the Sunstone History Podcast.
Well, I've sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I've sinned so gravely, Brother Young. That only you can save me, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. But only you can save me, Brother Young.
In modern times, when you think of church ladies, they're like this.
Hello, hello once again. I'm the church lady, and this is Church Chat.
Hi, this is Sister Jansen. I was just wondering if we could come visit teach you this Wednesday night. I'm Sister Jansen.
And I'm Sister Cook.
And we're your visiting teachers.
I heard Sister Allred drinks hot drinks.
Sister Allred?
Oh, that's such a nice picture of Braden, Jaden, and Hayden.
I just love scrapbooking. Elder Oopdorf is so handsome.
Oh, hi, Sister Cook. This is Sister Jansen. I was just calling to see what you're bringing to the ward potluck.
Popcorn popping on the apricot tree.
That's a hot drink. We don't drink that.
And I said, no, it's too low cut. Where's the shade shirt I bought you?
Did you see Bishop Kilpack fall asleep during testimony meeting last Sunday?
But what were they like in the early days of Mormonism? Think back to our Bad Girls episode. We talked about the religious culture at the time that Mormonism emerged. Historian Martha Sontag Bradley describes the Second Great Awakening as a, quote, coming out party for women, and noted how, quote, revivals pulled women out of their houses into the public arena onto a very public stage in unprecedented numbers and in unprecedented dimensions. The Second Great Awakening changed the lives of many women, enhanced possibilities for others, and empowered women in a way unheard of in our country's history, end quote. So with this background, she introduced a fantastic project in which she analyzed over 200 conversion narratives from early Mormons. Check out her summary of the five stages she identified in these stories. The first one, quote, the narrative described the individual's life before conversion as a life of sin, or at least as a time when she ignored the question of salvation, end quote. So these women that she's talking about, these women telling their stories of how they converted, they almost always seem to say that first their life was empty or was full of sin, or they had a question about salvation. The second thing she found from these narratives was, Quote, "This was a period of self-realization when narrators recognized their shortcomings and became aware of the need for change." So not only are they recognizing the sin, but they know that they want to change. They want to change their life for the better. Number 3, the heart of the conversion came when the individual turned her life over to God. Many described a sense of relief when freed from one's sins. So again, now these women are redeemed from something. If they convert, then their old ways are put behind them. Number 4, narrators then described how different their lives were because of the conversion in terms of behaviors and attitudes. For example, many replaced their drinking and carousing with group singing and worship. So old habits were replaced with new ones. First you're drinking and doing bad behavior, and then you're singing hymns in church.
Can we just stop for a minute and picture somebody like Eliza R. Snow getting up on the bar and, you know, singing drinking songs? I really hope that things like that happen, because if not, this is a big shame.
Number 5. In the final stage, the narratives varied the most. Some described self-doubt when the exhilaration of the earlier stages waned. Others experienced surges of rededication or persecution from the outside of the faith. And that makes sense to me. When something gets boring, sometimes we have to, you know, we want to remember, chase the dragon, if you will, and find the old feeling that we had before and find a way to reconstruct it. We talk about this later on, and when we get into the frontier period, the institution did this as a whole with the Mormon Reformation. But it's interesting to note that Bradley has documented that when women's testimonies would wane, they would do the same things on an individual level.
As Bradley described in her project, even though these women had some expanded opportunities in the religious sphere, the realities, the daily reality of living in a patriarchy was still very evident in their narratives. As Martha described, quote, "The issue of submission to God's will frequently figured prominently. Deference to God came naturally to women. Salvation was a metaphor for the relationships women had experienced since childhood. They had always been taught to defer to the authority of the men in their lives, to obey their fathers, to look to them for protection and guidance. Upon marriage, women slipped easily into the same type of relationship with their husbands. In fact, almost all women were identified by their connection to men as daughters, wives, sisters, mothers," close quote. Oof to that last sentence. This obviously is a problem we've talked about before, and let's face it, we're going to talk about it again. And now listen to how Valette Murray, wife of Heber C. Kimball, describes her conversion to Mormonism, quote, "Five elders of the Church of Latter-day Saints came to the town of Victor, which was 5 miles from Mendon, and stopped at the house of Phineas Young, the brother of Brigham. Hearing of these men, curiosity prompted Mr. Kimball to go and see them. Then, for the first time, he heard the fullness of the everlasting gospel and was convinced of its truth. Brigham Young was with him. At their meetings, Brigham and Heber saw the manifestations of the Spirit and heard the gift of speaking and singing in tongues. They were constrained by the Spirit to bear testimony to the truth, and when they did this, the power of God rested upon them. Desiring to hear more of the saints, in January 1832, Heber took his horses and sleigh and started for Columbia, Bradford County, Pennsylvania, a distance of 125 miles. Brigham and Phineas Young and their wives went with him. They stayed with the church about 6 days, saw the power of God manifested, and heard the gift of tongues, and then returned rejoicing, bearing testimony to the people by the way. They were not baptized, however, until the following spring. Just 2 weeks from that time, I was baptized by Joseph Young with several others." Interesting. Notice that Valette doesn't even come up till the last half of the last sentence, and we get not a hint as to her feelings or her experience. Now, we will do our absolute best to pull apart these narratives and extract the women from them. They're in there, and we'll get their voice out as much as possible.
Plain and true, saw something that few people do. Lord God, I think I've seen enough.
It's interesting for me to read these frontier narratives, because right now history is documentary history. The best history, the best we can do, is what we call documentary history, which is where we go to the documents for our evidence, right? So if it's written down, if it were written down or typed or on some document, then we count that as legitimate. And everything else, we just have to piece together and is considered less reliable. So think about that. Think about your own lives. if your whole story were told with only the documents you left behind, it would tell a picture of you for sure, but it wouldn't tell a complete picture of you. And so I've always tried to remember that when I read these histories, especially these autobiographies of women. But one of the other things that I think is really hard to account for, and one where documentary history kind of fails, and I honestly don't know how to remedy it because it's really complicated, is this idea of who are they writing to and how are they editing themselves? I mean, as a faithful Mormon LDS girl, I wrote in my journal knowing that my kids would read it someday, and I purposely left things out sometimes. Not really experiences, but more the depth of my feelings or any doubts that I had. I would omit those. And other things I would amplify and maybe tell that in a way, because I knew that it wasn't just for me. It wasn't that I was telling the truth. I was telling a lesson through my life because that's how I was taught to record my history. So how are these women telling the histories? Who are they reading it for? Who are they editing it for? What constraints did they feel? All of those are complicated.
These gaps that documentary history inevitably leads to are tough. And we've got a great example of one way to deal with them recently with the biography of Jane Manning James written by Quincy Newell. She brings a couple things to the table. One, she's not Mormon, never been Mormon. And so she has the ability to kind of step back from the story without a dog in the fight and just tell an amazing, fascinating story. But another thing that she's done is she has read very, very widely. So she knows what kind of the general broad brushstroke picture of what it meant to be a woman of color within Christianity at that time. And bringing that to the table, she can say, all right, documentary history may not tell us exactly what was going on in this event with Jane. However, we can make some very educated and very plausible guesses about what she might have done in this situation, how she might have reacted to it. And so there are ways to get around it, and rightfully so, Quincy Newell's book has received a lot of praise and attention recently. We're very happy to have on the episode today Brittany Chapman Nash. Brittany has done lots of interesting things in her life. So she was an employee of the Church History Library. She has worked a lot with one of her ancestors, Ruth May Fox, and along with Rick Turley has edited a series called Women of Faith in the Latter Days that has incorporated amazing biographies of many women. So some that are well known and some that are not so well known. And so we're very happy to have her come and talk about how Mormon women told their narratives, why they told their narratives, and some of her research.
Okay, we are so lucky to have Brittany Chapman Nash, who is a historian for the church and has participated in this beautiful series, A Desert Book. I think you can get it elsewhere too, but it's the Women in Faith series. Is that right?
Women of Faith in the Latter Days. 4 volumes are currently published.
And I have to tell you that series has been really important to me personally because this is how the women in my family sort of connect generationally. So we like to talk about women's history and church history. So this is really cool. Okay. So we brought you on because we wanted to ask you a few questions, but first, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Okay. So I started learning about women in church history in graduate school, just became fascinated and deeply connected to what I was learning about and the women. And so that's how it began. And I started working at the Church History Library in 2008 and, 10 years later gave birth to a beautiful son and wanted to stay home with him. So it's been about a year since I had my last day of work at the library. So I'm no longer employed at the church, but I still do book projects on the side and research on the side. So history is still very much a part of my life. And I have been working on a book about polygamy. So I am fascinated by the work you've done, Lindsay, on polygamy with your podcast. And so anyway, that's been an interest.
It's hard to talk about Mormon women without talking about polygamy, I think.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, in this series right now, we're still in early women of the church. And when we started this podcast, I don't think I realized how ignorant I was to early church history. I mean, just sort of excavating these stories has been really challenging and really exciting. Yeah. But Tell us, when you think of early women in the church, what are some words that you think of? How do you view these women? What should we know about them?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think, like you said, I feel like about half of the story of church history is told, and that's usually the male side of the story. In the past, that is changing, gratefully, and will continue to change. But I'm excited about the stories of women being more known now. So as I think about words to describe them and their involvement in the unfolding of church history, I first think of how they were exploring their own autonomy and sort of pushing boundaries at the beginning, especially of the organization of the church. Because if we think about it, they're all coming from these different religious backgrounds to this brand new faith. Not all of the tenets of the faith were organized yet, and Joseph Smith was still receiving revelation about doctrine. And so in some ways, it was sort of this flexible slate that people could add to, and the leadership of the church, for the most part, were really young people, forward thinking, just trying to discover truth. And so I think women came on board with this excitement and zeal and wanting to discover their place in the church. And the predominant thought at this time, as far as women's position in society and their place in religious structure, fell under this idea of male headship that was really deeply rooted in Western Christian society. And that was mostly based on biblical texts that declared men to be the head of woman and women to have inherited Eve's curse to be ruled over by men. So that was a really popular and common perspective. So women kind of accepted this secondary role or complementary role to men with them as the natural leaders. And that belief shaped families, religious structure, and society at every level. And we also see that in the church. But I think there was also this excited flexibility as the church was unfolding. And
oh, I love that word, excited flexibility. That's
And I think we see that in the establishment of the Relief Society, which was in 1842. And it was unusual because it was actually considered part of the organization of the church, according to, you know, Sarah Kimball's reminiscences of what Joseph Smith said and others. That was what they came away with understanding, was that, you know, it was a formal part of the church. It wasn't just a benevolent society or missionary society, like other women's organizations were, that were kind of ancillary to the church they may have been associated with. So they were important, and it became a space for women to lead and initiate change. And I think they really felt that enthusiasm.
Do you have some stories that, that would reflect that?
Yeah. And one of them, the first one that I thought of was their concept of healing. And again, this kind of folds into both discovering what church doctrine, church stance was on this, and then also then just kind of experimenting and going forward with different religious practices and sort of finding out what worked and what was acceptable and what doctrine was. So there was confusion coming from all these different religious backgrounds, like these women did. There was confusion about whether or not it was appropriate for women to lay hands on the sick, or if it was to be something that just men did, and whether or not they could, as women, give blessings of healing. And so there's minutes of one of Joseph Smith's visits to the Relief Society in April 28th. The date was April 28th, 1842, that he came and gave a sermon to the members of the Relief Society. And he addresses this confusion, talking about spiritual gifts. And this is quoting from the Relief Society minutes. He says, If the sisters should have faith to heal the sick, let all hold their tongues and let everything roll on. Respecting the female laying on hands, he further remarked, there could be no devil in it if God gave his sanction by healing, that there could be no more sin in any female laying hands on the sick than in wetting the face with water, that it is no sin for anybody to do that, to do it that has faith, or if the sick has faith to be healed by the administration. So there he's saying it's okay for women to lay their hands on the sick, and the fact that people are being healed through their faith, both the faith of the women healing and those receiving the blessings of faith. So God is giving his sanction just by the fact that it's working, basically, if that makes sense. So he's saying it's correct that women can heal. So that I think is pretty interesting and unique to, well, I'm not sure how unique it is, you know, as far as how many other religions were doing it.
I think you could say that it's unique and it's like outgrowth, it's outcropping of what it produced, right?
Yeah.
When you take those spiritual gifts and you sort of intersect them with Mormon theology, it does manifest in a really unique way, I think.
Yes. Yeah.
Keep in mind, I'm very Utah Mormon, so
very homogenous. Well, it's definitely a different look at things than what we currently understand, how we currently see gifts of healing and what blessings, what the laying on of hands mean and blessings mean. And so over time, that sort of understanding has shifted a little bit, or at least the exercise of faith, how that's manifested has shifted. So, and then another term that I think of is sisterhood. I feel like they had this really deep, rich bond of sisterhood in their early days, especially because they experienced so much hardship together and sacrifice and opposition that kind of banded them together. They really relied on each other's faith to sustain them. And we see patterns of them meeting. And this is even after the Relief Society was disbanded in Nauvoo, the women still continued to gather informally as they trekked across Iowa and in winter quarters and in other places. That was just part of their relationships and religious worship to gather together and to sustain one another through their faith and through exercising those spiritual gifts that they practiced in the Relief Society and in their just informal meetings. And so you may have heard of Patty Sessions before.
Patty Sessions, I mean, we talk about her a lot in the Year of Polygamy because of her connection to Joseph Smith as a plural wife, but her midwifery and all of that is really critical to a lot of the stories of the church.
Yes. Yeah, it is. And she records some beautiful, just short snippets of these meetings of women, across Iowa and in these other places where we don't really think of formal gatherings of women. We kind of forget that. And in this sort of interim where the Relief Society didn't formally exist, but I would love to share just a few passages from her diary, some of these meetings. And this is so her diaries they were transcribed and published by Donna Tolan Smart by the Utah State University Press. They put together a fantastic series of frontier life writings of Mormon women. And so actually a couple of these entries that have been transcribed. So this is from May 1847. So May 29th, 1847. She writes about going to a meeting to Eliza Beeman's with many of the sisters. Sister Young and Whitney laid their hands upon my head and predicted many things that I should be blessed with, that I should live to stand in a temple yet to be built. And Joseph would be there. I should see him. And then I should officiate for my labors should then be done in order. And they should be great. And I should be blessed and by many. And there I should bless many. And many should be brought unto me saying, your hands were the first that handled me. Bless me. And after I had blessed them, their mothers would rise up and bless me.
for they would be brought to me. And the blessing continues. And she writes, my heart was filled with joy and rejoicing. And the next day she writes about Sister Eliza R. Snow and others. They met together and had a good time, she says, and that many came and had a feast of good things of the kingdom there in the evening. We went to Sister Kimball's, had a glorious feast of feeling and hearing. So you get a sense of this beautiful religious worship that they enjoyed together in a uniquely feminine way, and strengthened and supported each other.
That's amazing.
Yeah, I really love that.
And that's something I want to point out, because often in history we talk about men being the strong ones, right? But it's just how we value power, and it's how we value strength. And in so many ways, these women are expressing these very same things, just in a sort of gendered unique way.
Yeah, totally.
Okay, is there any others you want to talk about?
Yeah, I think just one more thing that comes straight away to mind is just their experience. I mean, something that is talked about so often and is really a strength is the level of sacrifice that they were willing to go through in the name of faith for what they believed. And there's a story about Abigail Abbott that's published in Women of Faith, Volume 1. And she's always intrigued me because, well, I mean, she's a little known member of the church, and she also sort of follows the pattern of women before her, I think, in just exerting herself and wanting women to be remembered and honored for their contributions, even though they may not be visible. So this is in Utah in June 1852. So she learns that in the upcoming July 4th Independence Day celebration, that members of the Mormon battalion will be honored. And she wrote a letter to Brigham Young expressing her happiness that this would occur because her husband was among those men. And she said she felt a thrilling sensation as she thought back upon her own story during the 3.5 years that her husband was away from her. This was during some of the most trying times of church history, I feel like, as they trek across Iowa and try to establish themselves there in those temporary settlements, where they just really struggle along. So she's doing this all on her own and preparing, like making money to prepare for the trek across Utah. And she, does that alone with her children. And so in this letter to Brigham Young, she recounts all that she did during her husband's absence and how hard she worked literally night and day to support and to feed her family during this time. She suggested that the women and children left behind should also be remembered and honored at the celebration. And she does this in a pretty subtle way. I mean, not overtly demanding that it be the case, but, she, near the conclusion of her letter, she says, I would like an expression from Sister Eliza R. Snow, if there is no objection, and if the wives of those brethren that went in the battalion merit any applause or reward, I hope they will get it. And so I just admired her boldness, because I think it did take some courage and boldness on her part to write to Brigham Young and say, women need to be remembered, even though their acts may not be publicly paraded, that they've really carried on the church during difficult times. I like her story for that reason. And it does show a little, some might say, like feminist independence, that she recognized the value of her own contribution in a more male dominated world. I mean, in echoing what she said, that women, I also just hope and believe that as time continues, that women will continue to be remembered for their contribution in the simple and small things that kept the church moving forward, and for their incredible religious zeal that really did lay the foundation that later church members built upon as they taught their families, raised their children, and their children came to mirror their commitment to this vision of Zion that they had, of course, you know, with their husbands but women all would agree at that time, I think, were the primary caretakers of their families and prepared the generations to follow for with that faith and religious zeal that I think we continue to see and still see today. So,
well, that's beautiful. Thank you so much, Brittany. That was beautiful. And is there anything that you want to promote, anything you want to share with the audience, ways that they can better support your scholarship?
Well, I think just continuing to learn about women's history, to support women's history. There's some great organizations promoting women's work. The first one that comes to mind is the Mormon Women's History Initiative Team, also called MWIT. And there's a Facebook page called I Love Mormon Women's History that MWIT sponsors, and they keep it updated with just some great stories, quotes, and other things like that that highlight women's history and bring it to the forefront. Also, notifying people of events or lectures that may be upcoming that focus on women's history. Yeah, and also just I encourage people to record their own histories, maybe investigate their ancestors' histories if they have ancestors in church history, and teach people about their stories.
Okay. Well, so, thanks again for coming on.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Let's dig into the question of what attracted women to Mormonism in the early years. What did the religion have to offer them? Not surprisingly, in all of these narratives that we're talking about, a big common theme was the allure of the Book of Mormon. One of the more interesting accounts comes from Mary Adeline Beeman. If that last name sounds familiar, you are correct. We mentioned her father, Alva, in the Magic World View episode. He was a village rodsman in Palmyra and was apparently bummed not to get a cut of the loot when Joseph Smith announced he had found the gold plates. Mary mentions the local excitement about the, quote, Golden Bible. Her father, Alva, bought a copy once it was published, and Mary borrowed it. She also lent it to some people where she was teaching school. One who read it was Joseph Noble, who often went by Bates, and she later married him.
Mary Elizabeth Rollins described a similar experience. So when she's 12, she saw the Book of Mormon for the first time. Isaac Morley, who we will talk more about in the next episode, had the only copy in town, and she was on her way to a meeting that was going to be held that night. She described what happened, quote, "I went to his house just before the meeting was to commence and asked to see the book. Brother Morley put it in my hand. As I looked at it, I felt such a desire to read it that I could not refrain from asking him to let me take it home and read it while he attended meeting. He said it would be too late for me to take it back after meeting, and another thing, he had hardly had time to read a chapter in it himself, and but few of the brethren had even seen it. But I pled so earnestly for it, he finally said, 'Child, if you will bring this book home before breakfast tomorrow morning, you may take it.' He admonished me to be very careful and see that no harm came to it." Close quote. If her story at this point is sounding familiar, you are right again. Mary Elizabeth's narrative was part of this mashup that was done to create the main character in Legacy, the movie shown at the Joseph Smith Memorial Building for years and years and years. And yes, you are correct. The woman that played the main character in Legacy was married to Thomas Dolby, responsible for this.
Brother Jacob, I have your lunch whenever you're ready.
You're a man of obvious good fortune, Brother Jacob.
And I want to talk about that for a minute. So as we're talking about what attracts women to the church, of course, I was born into the church. I was not a convert, so I can't really understand the lure, especially in the context of the time, right? But if Bradley's analysis of all of these narratives is correct, one of the things is people feel like they're fundamentally flawed, right? And in any marketing, like we talk about the beauty industry, to sell makeup to people, you have to tell them that there's something wrong with them. Well, Christianity has the elements of that, right? We are flawed. We are sinful. We are, in Mormonism, we call the natural man as an enemy to God, and we need to be redeemed from that. Victorian culture, especially frontier culture, which was a little wild, was probably rife with some of those tensions of feeling a lot of shame and sinful lust and things like that. But there's also this, what we've talked about in our other episode, this romance with Native Americans at the time and with colonization and how to make sense of being the colonizer and grappling with what that meant. And so I imagine that all of those things were sort of a romantic idea. When you think about it, the Book of Mormon is a really romantic tale of American Indians. And so I can see that that appeal. I mean, there's a whole host of academic literature that talks about white Victorian American women being obsessed and even aroused by the idea of this fantasy Native American and how, you know, romance novels and dime novels and a whole culture grew out of this. And some have said that the Book of Mormon is Joseph Smith's sort of attempt to play Indian. And this is just a good plug for Angela Poley Hudson's book, Real Native Genius, How an Ex-Slave and a White Mormon Became Famous Indians, because it talks about this time period where Joseph Smith is actually trying to, I mean, the whole purpose of the church was to convert Native Americans. So I can see why that allure is really popular. But there's another piece that I think that this one I can actually understand. If you look at the elements, if you want to see what the appeal was to these women, it was undeniably the personal charisma of the missionaries. We hear about this still now, you know, especially people in the global South who haven't seen Americans before, and Americans coming in there, these cute, you know, charismatic, energetic teenage boys, that is appealing. But the same thing was the case, you know, in frontier America, where you had really rough and tumble life, hard scrabble life, and then you have these two handsome men coming in from New York State or something and telling you this beautiful story. And a woman who was caught up in it was Nancy Alexander. She was living in New York when David W. Patton visited on a missionary journey. After all the reports of Mormons in the newspapers, she said, quote, "I had hardly expected they were human from what I heard. The house was filled, waiting to see this wonderful man. My astonishment was better felt than described when he appeared tall and stately with piercing black eyes filled with the Spirit of God. He was full to the brim. All eyes were upon him, and you could have heard a pin drop," end quote. Okay, think about this now. So it's not only the lure of the American Indian romance, but it's also this idea that Mormons are evil and wicked and they're coming to town, right? And then they show up and they're these handsome men filled to the brim with the Spirit of God. Mary Beeman had a similar reaction to hearing Mormon preachers, quote, "Brother Joseph Young and Brother Brigham Young, Father Smith and Samuel had been to Father's before this on business. But when I came to see the two Brother Youngs, I had a testimony in myself that they were servants of the Lord, for they looked different to me than any other men I ever saw. They carried an expression in their countenance that bespoke men of God," end quote. Then when Joseph Smith came to town, it was kicked up to 11, because after Mary met this increasingly famous guy, she wrote, quote, "His society I prized, his conversation was meat and drink to me," end quote. And there are other women that talk about his, you know, piercing, beautiful blue eyes. They could see right through them. I mean, these missionaries had an aura of allure and attractiveness to them.
And this is kind of an interesting glimpse of Brigham Young, particularly because we know later on, personal charisma, particularly with women, not his strong suit. And also, I've mentioned this before, and maybe I'm just the weirdo here, but I mean, from our modern eyes, remember later on, Brigham Young will go on record talking about his dislike for bathing, let's say, on a regular basis. And so, yet, he's something of interest early on. So maybe he bathed more in those days. But at the core, what was it in the message that sucked in these women? This is the part that is maddeningly difficult to pin down. Listen to a few statements from these women. Many were astonished at his message, for it was so much different from what it had been reported. I realized that they were in possession of something that I was not. I well remember his powerful sermon on the first principles of the gospel, as taught by the Savior and his apostles. Oh, how plain and beautiful and easy to understand. And we had many mysteries unfolded to our view, which gave me great consolation. What were they? Could you be a little more specific, please? Reading through these conversion narratives, it's difficult sometimes to really identify just what elements of the preaching spoke to them. And part of the problem is almost all of these accounts that we have, unfortunately, are reminiscent. So these women are often toward the end of their life, thinking back, and they remember the general feeling of their conversion, but by this time, the specifics have kind of slipped away.
And I totally would have been sucked into this because I'm one that, you know, if I hear that somebody is strange or weird and then they show up at my door, I'm going to want to have a conversation with them. And so I can totally see the appeal to these men.
Just a side note, this is how I got on the podcast, by the way. She's like, oh, he's strange and weird. Maybe I should have conversations with him.
It was actually the opposite. He was strange and weird, and I didn't want to have a conversation with him. And now look at us. We're saddled together for eternity. Okay, so we know that they like the Book of Mormon, they like the message of the Book of Mormon, and they like the messengers. But that would be reducing women to, you know, only objectifying the handsome missionaries. But there are other aspects to what attracted women to this movement, and one of them stands out, spiritual gifts. The ability to let these women participate, to actively participate in these spiritual experiences, communing with angels, dreams, healing, speaking in tongues. These things really appealed to these women. And the women that were part of the early Mormon movement were very engaged in all of these gifts. Remember that the seeker culture of the time yearned for this mythic New Testament world of healing blind people and raising the dead and cloven tongues of fire and all the dramatic and moving stories from the time of Jesus and the apostles. And plus you mix it in with, you know, this whole Victorian culture coming out of the Great Awakening, this sort of frontier fervor. It just makes sense that this would have appealed to them. For example, Melissa Morgan was apparently blind for over a decade, but after her baptism, when she was confirmed, quote, her great faith, her sight was restored to her when she was administered to by the prophet Joseph Smith's father, Joseph Smith Sr., and another elder. After this miracle, she was given a Bible of fine print and was able to read it with ease. She then asked for a hymn book, which was given her, and she sang in tongues and then talked in tongues, in which she was told of things her family would do and of their journey to the West, end quote.
See, and we're, okay, tangent time here. Speaking in tongues, it's so fascinating. And this is one of those elements that really, as a modern observer, is so foreign to us. Chris talked about this before. There were kind of two ways of thinking about it. One was, and this is the way modern LDS interpretation has kind of taken it, that this allows you to speak in a foreign tongue. So this is missionary work. Like, you know, you go to the Philippines and you can pick up Tagalog really, really quickly. Okay. But in their time, it was definitely this other form. And there's great, you know, 25-cent words that you can use at parties to sound really smart. And we're not even going to say them. So there. But this other way is that, you know, it's essentially gibberish until it gets interpreted by someone else. And if you think about it, they can kind of do whatever the Spirit directs them to. And I would love to see an account, and there's got to be one somewhere. I mean, I can't imagine this never happened, that the person interpreting gives their interpretation, and the person speaking in tongues is like, whoa, hold on, that was not at all what I had in mind, dude. And then, you know, they get in a fight. So if you find that account, please email that to us. Thank you.
I love it. I love that she was healed and then reading hymns and speaking in tongues. That's really interesting if you think about that. You can imagine that if they're doing New Testament healings, that those stories are going to spread like wildfire. Rhoda Richards describes how she was afflicted with cancer in her face. She already had one removed, and spoiler alert, no local anesthetic, no sterilized instruments, yada yada, just like straight off, get your butcher knife out and slice it off. And she had done this before, and she was not looking forward to this. So she talked to the presiding elder at a meeting and asked for a blessing. And this is what happened, according to the documentary history. The elder called upon the sisters present to unite their faith and prayers in my behalf and upon the brethren to come forward and lay their hands upon me and bless me in the name of the Lord Jesus Christ, according to my desire. It was done, and I went home completely healed and rejoicing in the God of my salvation. So no butcher knife, I guess. Now we're talking. This is something concrete that helps us to understand the appeal of Mormonism. Being healed. If you have cancer in your face and the elders can remove it, that's pretty compelling. Let's see what Christopher has to say.
Hello again, podcast listeners. This is Christopher C. Smith, back to talk about why female converts joined the early LDS church. I want to credit Martha Sontag Bradley and Mary Brown Firmage. I used their book, Four Zinas, A Story of Mothers and Daughters on the Mormon Frontier, for my research for this episode. Absolutely fantastic book, beautiful and haunting. Highly recommend it. So Bradley and Firmage tell the story of Zina Baker, originally from Plainfield, New Hampshire, and she married William Huntington. So her married name is Zina Baker Huntington. And the Huntingtons settled at Watertown, New York in 1805. Zina's a young bride. She's 19 years old. 30 years later, they joined the LDS Church in 1835. So there's 30 years intervening there. And Bradley and Firmage basically identify four main things that Zina and her daughters found appealing about the LDS Church when they finally do join the LDS Church. And those are a larger sense of family, reassurance in the face of death and disease, and a sense of female empowerment. I'm going to talk about each of those in turn, but in order to understand why those things were so powerful to them, you have to understand a little bit about their family life. So I'm going to talk a little bit about those intervening 30 years of her married life before Zina finally joined the LDS Church. So let's start with the larger sense of family. So to understand why Zina later found the LDS Church appealing, you have to understand some of the context of her life. She had 10 siblings, including a twin sister named Lina. If you know anything about twins, if you've ever known a pair of twins, they tend to be really close. And when she married and moved to Watertown, she left this big family behind in New Hampshire. And her biological family almost never visited her. And her letters home are just filled with like a sense of longing to see them again. She missed them so much. And of course, she integrates with her husband's family and gets along pretty well with them. She raises 10 kids of her own. But your in-laws are never quite the same as your own parents and siblings. I think most of us who have experienced that can testify to that. Now, family gives you a sense of belonging and identity, and it can be super disorienting to suddenly be separated from your family. And it was even more disorienting in the 19th century because at the time, kinship is still very much the basis of social organization. There were lots of complaints back in the 1980s from the conservatives about how the family was breaking down as a unit of social organization. And to a great extent, they're harking back to this 19th century culture where family was everything. And it's not quite so much that way anymore, although I think maybe the death of the family has been exaggerated. But according to Bradley and Firmage, Zina and William lived and worked together alongside brothers and sisters, mother and father in a kinship network, a complex of homes, fields, and resources defined by familial relationships. The roads between their homes and the footpaths they took to borrow tools or to share stories were like threads binding them together. And you got to remember, 19th century women were often sick and they were constantly pregnant, because birth control was not really a thing yet. And so they couldn't put their domestic duties on hold whenever they got sick or pregnant. And their domestic duties were way bigger than they are today. They were not just cleaning house. They were making products for the family. They were, you know, making candles and soap and clothing. Everything that the family needed and relied upon was being, you know, produced for the most part in the home and by the family. So women relied heavily on help from family members like parents and siblings when they had these times of illness or pregnancy. And before the welfare state, family was your only social safety net. If you got crippled or you got sick, you depended on family. There was no government disability check coming. So Zina named 5 of her children for family members, which gives you some idea how important family was at the time. Now, imagine suddenly having to leave the family network that's defined your life and identity for the first 20 years of your life. You've never known anything else. If you can imagine that, then you'll have some idea of the plight of young brides in the 19th century. So one of the things that religion does, and especially Mormonism does really well, is create what some scholars call fictive kinship. Fictive as in fictional or imagined kinship. The ironic thing is that fictive kinship can end up being more real than your actual kinship. Bradley and Firmage say that women experienced a phenomenon not unlike a new birth into an extensive family of sisters and brothers, a family that promised to be more secure than their original family. you know, Mormons call each other sister and brother in sort of a homage to this sense of fictive kinship. And in a sense, baptismal water is thicker than blood, right? Because this fictive family can be even more reliable than your real family. And this idea of kinship between believers becomes more and more central to Mormon doctrine over time. Joseph Smith develops more elaborate sealing rituals to bind the religious community together as an eternal family. And Zina's family gets even bigger in Nauvoo when she marries first Joseph Smith as a plural wife and then Brigham Young as a plural wife, becoming one of many plural wives. So she ends up with a very, very large eternal family, suffice to say. So that's the first thing Mormonism offers women, is a more secure sense of family in a culture where family is everything, but family can also be really insecure. Second thing is reassurance in the face of illness and death. And that, you know, we just talked about how important the family was. Now imagine having family members continually killed in horrific, painful ways, and you'll have some idea of what life was like in the 19th century. Bradley and Firmage give a few examples that Zina and her husband William shared in their letters. These are like pieces of local news. On three separate occasions, William reported men found frozen to death near Watertown. A man named Stephen Arnold murdered a kid and got hanged in town. A little girl accidentally got shot. A man accidentally cut off his own leg. A woman murdered her four children and then committed suicide. Another woman lost three children and her husband to an epidemic of disease that struck the town. Now, this is a little town. There's like 200 families in this town. I mean, this would be normal news in a big city like New York or Philadelphia, but this is a small community where you basically know everyone. So you just imagine those kinds of things happening on a regular basis so close to you. And tragedy struck closer to home, too. William serves in the militia during the War of 1812. Zina can hear the thunder of cannons from a nearby battle on one occasion. Lots of soldiers got sick and died, and William apparently came home sick with the measles and infected his four-year-old son, Dimmick. And Dimmick was blinded by measles for 6 months, and it caused him such pain that he screamed and danced and spat, nearly drowned in the bathtub. Vaccinate your children, people. Dimmick survived the measles, but Zina's twin sister, Lina, and her infant daughter both died of diseases. And later in 1833, Zina's two-year-old grandson, Silas Buell, fell into a huge brass kettle full of boiling cider, and he died from burns after 13 hours of horrible agony. And Prezinda Huntington Buell, Zina's daughter and Silas's mother, was pregnant at the time that Silas died, and that baby died soon after birth. I mean, these were horrifying times, scary, scary times. So Zina, who is a Presbyterian at the time that these things are happening, sought a lot of consolation in religion. She wrote of her dead daughter, "My little desirable babe is taken from my breast, and she now sleeps in death. She has gone to him who gave her," meaning Jesus. And of her twin sister, she prayed that the Lord Jesus would be better to her than parents, husband, or children would be, and she consoled herself that this is the work of his hands. So she's finding a lot of consolation in religion and in the hope that she's going to be reunited with these family members after death and that they're well taken care of in heaven. And after these deaths, her letters become more and more concerned about her own spiritual state. She expresses a lot of worry about this. And in 1820, she wrote, "Now, my dear friends, we feel heaven born and heaven bound. I hope, dear friends, that we enjoy the peace of mind that the world cannot give nor take away. I wish we might all be so happy as to meet in a better world than this." So she's got a lot of anxiety about death, but it seems to have made her more religious. She found a lot of solace and a lot of peace of mind in religion, even in the face of these horrible tragedies. And there's a historian named Sam Brown who's argued that the conquest of death was Mormonism's biggest theme and its greatest appeal. And I think he makes a pretty good case for that. Mormonism answered a lot of big questions about things like what happens to children who die before baptism. Well, it introduces the idea of age of accountability. Anybody who dies before 8 years old automatically goes to heaven. And Mormonism provides a way to save your unconverted family members. So it removes that anxiety about what happens to family members who, for instance, died before Mormonism was founded, or for whatever reason never got to hear about Mormonism. Well, you're going to be able to baptize them for the dead, perform rituals that reassure you that you are going to be reunited with them in the afterlife. So in a lot of ways, it provides a much more reassuring picture of the afterlife than traditional Christian doctrine did. It was just the thing for a mother who's lost a bunch of children, or parents and siblings and other family members. And religion also offers the possibility of escaping death, right, through miraculous healing, which is something that Mormons really emphasized in the early period of the church. And so, for example, when Zina's son Dimmock injured his ankle, he got an infection in the bone, which at the time they didn't have antibiotics. So that's a really life-threatening thing, to get a bone infection. And a surgeon removed a portion of the bone and advised the Huntingtons to amputate the whole leg, but Zina refused that. So she just prayed over it and treated the wound with cool clay. And fortunately, eventually Dimmock got better. And she attributed that to divine healing. And if this sounds familiar, it's because we already talked about almost the identical thing having happened to Joseph Smith. Same thing, infection in the bone, doctor performs a radical leg surgery, removes a portion of the bone, tells the family to amputate the leg, but the mother refuses and prays over Joseph Smith, and he got better as well. And this actually was really common in the 19th century. It happened a lot. Doctors are often recommending amputation of infected limbs because this is a really life-threatening thing, but most people are making the risky decision to keep the limb because life is hard enough in the 19th century without also being a cripple. And religion is helping people rationalize these risky medical decisions by providing hope for the person's recovery and, of course, consolation if the person dies. So it provides explanations either way, no matter what happens, and it gives you some reassurance that what happened was meant to be. Okay, so now the third thing that religion offered women was a sense of female empowerment. So this is kind of a different note here than the other two. Mormonism at the time is not the only religion empowering women. Lots of churches, especially the Methodists and the Baptists, are allowing women to preach during this time. They're allowing women to practice the gift of healing, to prophesy, to speak in tongues. Historians have called the Second Great Awakening a coming out party for women because women are starting to exercise authority in churches in very public ways. They also start to engage in political activism with the temperance movement and other political movements that were really orchestrated and organized by women. But let's look specifically at Mormonism and specifically how it played out for Zina Baker Huntington's daughter, Zina Diantha Huntington. So another Zina, but the Zina the Younger. Zina Diantha was 13 or 14 when Hiram Smith and David Whitmer, a couple of Mormon missionaries, one of them Joseph Smith's brother, another one of the three witnesses, so very prominent Mormons, visited her home as missionaries. And Whitmer really urged Zina to be baptized. But her parents were away from home at the time, so initially she refuses. But then she saw a heavenly vision of a man going down into the water and baptizing someone. And so she accepted baptism in obedience to this vision that she had had. So she's not only receiving a vision, which in itself is a really empowering thing for a teenage girl to experience, but she's also making her own decision about baptism. She's not deferring to David Whitmer, and she's not deferring to her parents. She's deciding to be baptized based on her own religious experience. And then, not long after her conversion, she also spoke in tongues. Remember, this is where you sort of speak in a what sounds like gibberish to people around you, but the belief is that this is a genuine language that you have been empowered to speak, miraculously empowered to speak, even though you have never studied this language and you don't really understand what you're saying. So Zina says, "The gift of tongues rested upon me with overwhelming force." She was compelled to speak in this gibberish language. "And I was somewhat alarmed at this strange manifestation, and so I checked its utterance." She stopped herself. But she was alarmed to discover that upon stopping herself, the gift left her entirely. And she worried that she had offended the Holy Spirit by stopping herself from speaking in tongues. And so one day, as she and her mother are spinning together, she says, "I took courage and told her of the gift and of how I had lost it. And mother appreciated my feelings and told me to make it a matter of earnest prayer that the gift might once more be given to me. And Zina did that. She prayed and she was able to get the gift of tongues back, and she exercised that gift and the gift of healing for the rest of her life. She was known for her powerful, miraculous manifestations. And it's interesting that her mother supported her in that. There was no sense that this was an illegitimate thing for a 13-year-old girl to be doing. She was encouraged. And Mormon women today don't generally practice spiritual gifts because the church has redefined those things as priesthood ordinances, with priesthood being an all-male phenomenon. But in the 19th century, there's nothing stopping women from doing this. In fact, the leaders are encouraging this sort of behavior from women. So at least at the time that the Huntington women joined, I think they felt very empowered by this expectation that women would exercise spiritual gifts, that they would experience dreams and visions from God, and they would be able to heal and speak in tongues. So those are the three things I see as reasons that the women of the Huntington family joined Mormonism. That larger sense of family that it gave them, extended family of all your fellow believers or your family, the conquest of death and the comfort in the face of anxiety, and the promise of healing that if you're on the verge of death, you may be miraculously preserved from death by religious healing, and also the sense of empowerment to practice spiritual gifts and to determine your own spiritual destiny by making your own decision about things like baptism.
Unfortunately, though, piecing together the private religious life of early Mormon women much beyond this is difficult. There are very few diaries of men or women that exist for the first several years of Mormon history. They weren't in journal keeping as much as they were later on. And this is certainly an area that is ripe for more exploration. Still, though, it's interesting to think about. Women are so underrepresented as it is in Mormonism, and it's really interesting to me and to Brian why women were interested in the faith to begin with, what kept them there, and why women are interested now. I mean, even the thought of women converting to Mormonism is interesting to me. I track that in Mormon fundamentalism. I see what Mormon fundamentalism offers women. People will say, why will women convert to polygamous groups all the time? Well, women are longing for that care. They're longing for that family, that sisterhood. They're not just joining for the men, obviously, right? They're joining for the sisterhood. They know that their children will be taken care of. A lot of women that convert to fundamentalism are single mothers, and they know that they have a built-in family system. That might not make sense to a lot of people, but that's why they're doing it. What does the LDS Church bring to women? I wonder if someone did a study of all their narratives now, what the similarities would be. So that's why it's important. And a special thanks to all of our readers today who read for the voices of these Mormon women.
Listen up, kids. It's time for today's Books of Mormon. And today it truly is Books of Mormon. We are highlighting today the series Women of Faith in the Latter Days, edited by Brittany Chapman Nash, who you heard from, and Rick Turley, a series published by Deseret Book. There are 4 volumes out so far in the series, and they've split up the volumes based on the birth dates of the women involved. So you get kind of like a generational survey of how these women experience their religion. And it's interesting in the series because the authors and the subjects in the volumes are a blend of familiar and lesser known. So, for example, you have chapters written by Janice Johnson, Susan Easton Black, Jenny Reeder, and Laurel Thatcher Ulrich. So names that you've undoubtedly heard of, but then also authors that you're not familiar with. And the subjects, same thing. So they cover the lives of women like Valette Kimball, Emma Hale Smith, Liza R. Snow, but also Desideria Quintana de Yanez, who was baptized in 1880 as one of the first converts to the LDS Church in Mexico. So fantastic stories that you're not familiar with. The series is a great collection of short biographies of early LDS women and very highly recommended.
And just one final plug, this is going to go out before the Sunstone Summer Symposium happening on July 31st to August 3rd at the Mountain America Expo Center in Sandy, Utah. Come visit me. Come visit Brian. Brian's going to be at the benchmark table. I'm going to be running around like a crazy person, but we'd love to see you. We'd love to hang out with you at one of the biggest Mormon conferences other than General Conference that there is. So come hang out with us. And if you like what you're hearing, consider leaving a donation at sunstone.org so we can keep this podcast alive.
I beg you, spill my blood, oh Brother Young. And let it smoke ascend to heaven, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. And let my breast be cut asunder, Brother Young. As an offering for my sins, a smoking incense, Brother Young. A blood atoning for my sinning, Brother Young. 'Cause I sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I have sinned so gravely, Brother Young. Let only you can save me, Brother Brigham, Brother Young.
The song you heard today is called Brother Brigham, Brother Young by an artist, Corb Lund. Check out his music at corblund.com and consider giving a donation to sunstone.org to support this podcast.